This is an example of speech.
All our history.
Welcome to Tell Me What to Think, a free from oversight and free of charge, thoughtfully improvised, expletive deleted, details expanded, whistle-blow-hard, evergreen, topical heatwave of a weekly conversation-turned-podcast, in which we discuss politics, global affairs, current events, music, literature, social media, and anything else that bubbles up from the unmoderated comment section in our brains. We urge you to join us and tell us what you think. You can contact us at tmwttpod@gmail.com. I'm Peter Elbro. You can contact me on Twitter at Bloated Nemesis. And I have with me, as always and forever, Charles Minnick, who is on Twitter at Green_Weird, which is WYRD. This episode, we go around the world and revisit our talk about a progressive foreign policy for the United States and finish up with a load of Wisconsin election updates. Prepare to get righteous and reactionary. This is Tell Me What to Think. Time to get on our soap pod and tell you what to think. Now, for some weak thoughts.
Alright. Okay.
Welcome, everyone, to Tell Me What to Think. You can email the pod at tmwttpod@gmail.com. You can Twitter at me, Peter Elbro, at... Wait, I should make that clearer what I'm saying. My name is Peter Elbro. My Twitter handle is at Bloated Nemesis. And you can tweet at Charles. You can tweet to Charles. God damn it, that at thing. At Green_Weird, which is WYRD. Make sure to also use the hashtag TMWTT, Embarrassing Wisconsin, or Go Home Scott is a fun one lately that we see and check on and can read stories and talk about them online, or on the podcast. And you can find us on Google Play, Stitcher, Apple Podcast, and go find archive episodes at www.stoneduckmedia.com. How's it going, Charles?
Great. Another stormy day in Wisconsin today.
Yep, got wet this morning. Just trying to, park my car at school. It cleared up all right, though. Is it storming by you tonight?
Not yet. It's going to later.
Oh, it is. Okay. I did not know that. Well... So, let's start off talking about, I just saw, I think it came out about an hour ago, we are recording, as usual, Tuesday night, the Supreme Court lets stand a decision requiring dark money disclosure. I'm reading a headline from The Atlantic, but, so I went back and forth with our legal, correspondent Dave about this on Twitter. I realized I was really confused if you were to go back and read the exchange, and it's because I didn't get who was on which side, because I just assumed the Federal Elections Commission was on the side against the dark money conservative group, but turns out they were actually... because it's their loophole, they were actually defending the loophole.
Yeah, that is not intuitive.
I was totally dumbfounded. as soon as I pieced who was on which side, I was like, oh, I get this. And so it was a lawsuit brought by Crew, which are a good Twitter follow, actually. And they are an ethics group.
Citizens for Responsible Ethics in Washington.
Yep. And they sued the FEC and Crossroads PAC, or whatever it's called, which is that Karl Rove's?
Crossroads? Yeah, I think so.
Crossroads. I think that's Karl Rove's.
That's something up in the Bush era.
Yeah, and they are one of the biggest dark money groups. Dark money is when you file with the FEC as a, 501c4 or 501c6. According to The Atlantic here, that's considered a nonprofit organization, and so you don't have to disclose who your donors are. Well, ever since the famed Citizens United case, this has been this like glaring loophole in election advertising money disclosure. And the district court agreed with Crew on this and ordered that the dark money groups have to reveal their donors within 45 days. I believe that date came and went. So this was then in the appeals court. The appeals court, I believe, agreed with Crew again. And John Roberts, a few days ago, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, put a stay on that until it got all sorted out. And that actually only took a couple days. And the Supreme Court refused to take up the case, which means the decision stands.
Yeah, that's how it stands. Dark money, well, these, well, I guess it's not exactly transparency, but, you know, it's, they at least have to open up their books slightly.
Yeah, I mean, it's a, well, probably, this might be a theme through a few of the other kind of more domestic stories that we'll talk about today, and maybe some we won't get to, but, I have had this feeling for like a week now, kind of with the Paul Manafort thing, which we don't need to get into, but,
we're not going to talk about him.
Yeah, so what do we have to say, you know? We'll just wait to see whatever info comes out, you know? But I've had this feeling like, I don't know, it feels like the timeline is correcting itself just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
Dan Frumkin put out White House Watch, and again,
yeah.
It's like weird things are happening that are strangely positive.
Yeah, and it just feels like, you know, there's so many bad things out there too, but it's like if you can't acknowledge a little bit of the good, I mean, like you're just... just gonna make your brain rot. Anyway, so I suggest reading about this if you're into Supreme Court cases or you are into more transparency and ethics in elections. It'll be interesting. Like, this is gonna come out soon. I don't know the exact date on this reveal, but it is before the midterms. I mean, this is soon. They have to do this, like, soon. Oh, yeah. By the way, it's called Crossroads GPS.
Crossroads GPS, that was the name. Yep.
And it, like, they're not directly involved in the suits, but there were groups that were that will have to reveal their dark money, and like they were like the NRA,
ooh,
Americans for Prosperity, and it's Koch Brothers one, and and they're not all conservative, obviously, but there's another big conservative one. I'm blanking on it now. But anyway, it'll be... yeah, the NRA one is, like, intriguing, right? Because with their,
yeah,
their shit...
all those Russian donations and
but
all the oligarchs.
I don't know how far this info will have to go back.
Hmm.
Like, I think the logic is that it's retroactive to their current...
so situation. The people that they're taking money from now. Okay.
And the people... the money that they are spending right now, where did that money come from? I mean,
yeah, I can see it's not, they're not going to like open up their books or in any comprehensive way, but at least yeah, we'll know something.
Yeah. And hey, I mean, there'll be a commercial that's going to be airing next week in Wisconsin here or in Texas or Florida that you can see who's on the bottom and you can go see who the fuck's funding that. You could, like, you had to do some research to even like kind of get on the trail of some of this stuff before, like you'd see, like, because sometimes the billionaires make like press about it, so it's like Uline, you know, gave $1 million to this group or whatever.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So how about all the other assholes that also donated money?
All right. So, and then speaking of assholes who take money, there was this article about the Senate, which intrigued me. And it's not a well-written article. It's not from a perspective I agree with.
It's fair and balanced in the Fox News sense.
It's fair and balanced in the sense of the words that they don't mean anything. It's
words don't anymore.
Yeah, that's actually, who is the asshole who wrote this? Jay Cost. I don't know who that is. And anyway, it's about, notionally it's about restructuring the Senate. And he, actually the t- title actually says the Supreme Court, but he doesn't get too much into the Supreme Court directly here, except that
they rule on too many cases.
Is that his only point with them?
Well, I mean, I think it's that the Senate has undue influence over the Supreme Court. I mean, I'm still trying to work my way through it.
He says this in the headline is the Senate and the Supreme Court have been granted too much power. I don't know. And by the way, like this asshole, not even bringing up the president, really. You don't have a problem with the president having too much power today?
No, he's fine.
Really, his whole point is that the federal government has too much power. That's actually his only point. And he's using the lens of the Senate, and to a lesser extent, the Supreme Court, because people on the left have been complaining about those groups. But though, as he points out, people on the left have always been complaining about the Senate, no matter what.
I mean, people on both sides complain about every aspect of our government continuously. It's like part of the American tradition.
Yeah, like that's how we know we're working and it's right. Like functioning is that we are disagreeing about like the nuances of our representative democracy.
Yeah, it's not like should we have a constitution?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Although you can pick up like hints that this guy is one of those like. Constitutional convention type guys.
Like one of the originalists? Yeah.
Yeah, because he's like, our federal government's way too big ever since the New Deal and all those.
I love this quote. While the framers created a sensible balance between structure and power, subsequent generations have vastly expanded the latter while leaving the former the same. And that's the level of writing in this. Ugh.
You know what, though? There is a weird way that I do agree with him. I think this is kind of what got me to want to talk about it.
Okay.
And it's not that his conclusion... It's kind of like, I acknowledge his point and then come to the opposite conclusion, which is... Although I don't know what that is yet. That's why I want to talk about it. But it's that he says that it's like building... Okay, so having this massive federal government built upon a framework, a constitution for a... Much smaller, I mean, just country, much less...
Like a late 18th century, just barely post-colonial country?
Yeah, but even take out, like, the sort of, like, values of the time, which are, like, obviously important, because you're only talking about, like, the value of African-Americans and women and all that. But but just the, like, they didn't know it would be 300 million plus with 50 states... thousands and thousands of miles from coast to coast, all
more
of these...
More military power in one ship than
they
the entire...
They weren't even totally sure they'd have a standing military.
Right? We have more than the rest of the world combined.
And now that standing... Yeah. And now that standing military and, like, in general, the defense is, like, over half of our budget for this giant federal government.
Yeah, I don't think Jefferson or Washington would have been in favor of that. Not even Adams.
No, yeah. No. Adams, in his biography, it goes to length, say he hates the standing army. Towards the end of his, or as time went on, he actually became a big fan of a standing navy, which is interesting. But that's only because the other great powers were an ocean away from America.
Yeah. I mean, it'd really suck if Britain was suddenly like, hey, let's go send, like, not even a whole fleet, but just a couple of ships over to America just to fuck with them.
Yeah, and if you didn't have anything to protect your trade and your ports. Yeah, but anyway, so making the point that, like, this is not what they foresaw or intended, and so, like, he makes an analogy of, it's like, what does he say, like, an 11-story building on the...
No, it's the next paragraph. It's followed by a sentence with an exclamation mark, and then he makes the metaphor.
Oh, God.
Okay. Or he says it's analogous to trying to build a 50-story skyscraper atop a foundation meant for a 2-story home.
Yeah, that's it. Yep.
Fucking exclamation mark.
And I do think there's something to that. I mean, I think we all feel that at times... Whenever you kind of like start reading about the government and politics and
yeah, because it's like there's no way that the founding fathers intended for one individual person to be commander in chief of a standing military which could just reduce the entire world to a burning cinder within an hour.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think they were like...
I wouldn't have trusted Washington with that.
No, they barely trusted Washington with, like, leading the, like, retreats of their army. And, like, he was the biggest hero in America, and they still didn't really, like, trust him with anything. And then it's like, oh, but you know that someday, like, his 47th or, what is it, 45th, ancestor to this job will be, or, not ancestor, what's the opposite of ancestor? Descendant. Is going to be, you know, like a psychopath with like 10,000 nuclear weapons. And those, by the way, a nuclear weapon can destroy the planet.
And hey, a few more between now and then, or then and now.
Yeah, and then, every one of them, yeah. It's just... But anyway, so his... I mean, really, he's trying to argue for, like, the... Like, kind of libertarian, tear everything down, right?
Like the Tenth Amendment kind of shit.
Yeah.
Like, you know, power to the states, because, you know, that's what the Constitution and Bill of Rights originally enumerated, that the states would take care of everything not covered in the Constitution, which is a lot. Whole lot.
I mean, but, isn't the pure fact that... So he's... Like, isn't that a hypocrisy in his argument, though? Because he's saying... Okay, the Constitution specifically says that you can't do anything unless by the federal government unless it specifically says so. And so, but he also then makes the metaphor of how, you know, like, time has, like, he's complaining about the government itself, but I would argue it's time and circumstance and context over 300 years almost that have changed.
Really changed the nature of the game, so to speak.
Yeah, like, okay, so, like, he talks about changes made to the government after the Great Depression. Well, the Great Depression came because of big changes in finance and industry.
And communication.
Communications. You know, I mean, so he thinks states can handle all of this? I mean, it's a bad faith argument, right? He just doesn't want any of it handled.
Yeah, it's totally bad faith to start. Well, I don't need to starve the beast anymore. They're actually doing that, but yeah, it's at least incoherent, if not bad faith, not argued in bad faith.
It's hard to tell the coherence through all of the backhanded swipes at Democrats.
Well, did you see the title of his book?
God.
The Price of Greatness, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and the Creation of American Oligarchy. So American oligarchy is a good thing, and... yeah.
Wait, is that...
Anyway.
Oh, Jesus. You think that's what that means?
That is exactly what that means, because Madison and Hamilton are regarded as, by the libertarians, as, like, folk heroes, right?
Well, no, I mean, Madison was not kind of Hamilton. Hamilton isn't like a, he's not like a civil libertarian type. He's for a big federal government.
Well, he's more specifically for a big financial, footprint and, like, a central bank, which these crazy monetary libertarians are, which seems totally counterintuitive again, but we're not here to go over every philosophy.
No. And then what was the let me just we'll end on this line that we both thought was so he begins with, recently progressive public intellectuals have taken to complaining about the United States Senate. This is nothing new, admittedly. Progressives have been complaining about one thing or another in our Constitution at least since Woodrow Wilson was a professor at Princeton University.
Yeah, shut up, Jay Cost. You obviously know nothing about progressive politics.
Yeah, Woodrow Wilson was the Democrat who actually won because the progressives, Taft and Roosevelt, were fighting each other.
Yep, the centrist compromise candidate.
It's ridiculous. I mean, was there anything? I mean, he kind of had, like, a, I guess for the time, a maybe you could argue a progressive international outlook.
Yeah,
a little and bit, then he not just, that much. But
then he got into World War I as soon as he could.
Yeah. You can't make the argument he's a dove.
Fuck no.
But I guess what I'm arguing is, I mean, he's famed for being like wanting like these international institutions of diplomacy.
Well, it was the League of Nations was his idea, and that's huge and great.
But, I mean, and then he was like, he's one of the most famous racist presidents.
Yeah, famously racist.
It's like, I don't think, when you are more racist than the two, like, pro-business Republican, I mean, granted, Republican meant something different then, obviously.
Colonialists.
But yeah, like, Roosevelt and Taft, like, when you're more racist than the, like, silver spoon, colonialist dudes, it's like, you're pretty racist.
Yeah. Pretty racist.
All right. Well, speaking of progressive international foreign policy, we are going to, after the musical interlude, come back and do a little globe hopping and come back to a subject that we have liked in the past. A dramatic reading of an email from U.S. House candidate from North Dakota, Mac Schneider, sent to me, Peter Elbro. Dear Peter, it's mid-September and that means two things are in full swing, campaign season and football season. And whether it's heartfelt political discussions between friends or ribbing between UND and NDSU fans, things can get a little heated. On the campaign trail, I've talked about working with anyone when it helps North Dakota, while also fighting policies that hurt our state. But what you might not know is that I've worked cooperatively to bring people on both sides of the UND-NDSU divide together. The best example of this? My marriage. My wife, Crystal, graduated from NDSU. I graduated from UND. Crystal was a track athlete. I played football. Crystal was a 10-time All-American. I played football. So with homecoming for both UND and NDSU this week, we wanted to give you a chance to show your school spirit while also helping our campaign get our message out to Hawk fans, Bison fans, and everyone in between. Can you pitch in $25 by clicking the button below that corresponds with your school colors? We'll check back as we get closer to game day and let you know which side is winning. And if it's anything like when I went to UND, sorry in advance, Bison fans. We'll spare you additional Uncle Rico talk and leave the glory days stories for later. In the meantime, thanks for participating in the homecoming challenge. Thanks, Mac. Please note, nothing in this email should be construed as an express or implied association with or endorsement by UND, NDSU, or frankly, anything. It's just an email where we mention the names and nicknames of North Dakota's proud universities, like people do in normal conversation. Paid for by Mac Schneider from North Dakota. So, this past week, there was what I liked. There was a... Oh, great, now my computer's not going to bring it up. An article in the New York Times about... it had a provocative title. I thought I was going to be reading like a National Review-type article. That was going to be like, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is so stupid. Because the title was like, what does she know about the...
South China Sea.
Yeah, South China Sea. But yeah, man, like, I started reading that thinking like, all right, this guy's going to be a dick. And then I was like, oh, hey, this is just Charles's thing.
Yeah.
Charles has said this about these same people before, where they don't do a good job. Okay, well, anyway, you explain.
Okay, so, like we've said in previous episodes, progressives don't really have a coherent foreign policy. Bernie Sanders, to his credit and to the credit of his staff, did some pretty good things during the campaign in distinguishing himself from Clinton's more aggressive foreign policy, but, you know, there's still some words to be typed, you know, ideas to be fleshed out. For instance, as I've said before, we need to end the war. We can start using our diplomatic muscle and, hell, even our mercantile muscle to start selling, shall we say, more sustainable technological solutions to the rest of the world and give them something to emulate about America again. But, you know, that's far and away a crazy idea. But yeah, one thing that we could do is support UN peacekeeping operations, like, ever. I'm pretty sure the United States is not the biggest contributor to those missions.
Is that just, like,
Well, we contribute to, like, certain missions in, like, the Middle East, like Israel or observer missions along the Lebanese border and along the Egyptian border, but I'm sorry, what was your question?
Well, so I feel like since 9/11, we don't get involved in that shit because we are just too bogged down with our own self-made problems.
Yeah,
but before that, for what, almost 10 years, the reason we didn't do much of it was...
Just because we were bogged down in Iraq?
Well, no, I'm proposing since Black Hawk Down. Didn't that make us a little gun-shy on that?
In 93? Well, if you remember, Clinton had... It was controversial at the time for several good reasons, but Clinton had no small measure of success in nation-building by supporting the NATO peacekeeping operation in Bosnia-Herzegovina.
Okay, like, yeah, they so kind NATO, of
stabilized
yeah.
the Balkans. So after Bush went in, we suddenly fucking took that huge fucking body of knowledge that we had just acquired, and we're like, this is fucking useless, kicked it in the fire, and tried to do exactly that, and failed fucking in the worst way possible.
Ah, dude, I know.
So, we can look at what happened well in Bosnia. They had a multinational coalition of interested parties of people who had, you know, people from the neighborhood, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't centralized on... The onus wasn't on any one particular country.
Mm-hmm.
So the people, the local people, were able to make their voices heard more efficiently? That seems like the wrong word, but more strongly?
Yeah, yeah. They rang out. Out more. Yeah, okay, that's interesting. Does NATO do that much?
Beyond not anymore. I mean, not since 9/11. They've been attacking Afghanistan. They haven't needed to protect Fortress Europe, but, you know, they've been doing near constant military maneuvers or exercises in preparation for the feared Russian attack.
Yeah. Okay, that's interesting. So this article, which I think is just being provocative, to be honest, by even just mentioning Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, I feel like it's a little bit picking on her, but his point is a good point for her and other, you know, progressives and democratic socialists.
Well, I'd pick on them because I want to see them improve. Hopefully you did the same
exactly.
thing.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it's just like, I mean, you know, like, you could have written the same article that doesn't mention her and doesn't have a big picture of her. You know? That's the only reason I say it.
That's
but I don't know, it is New York Times, she's a New York politician, so I don't know, I guess it makes sense. It says here, it's Daniel Besner is a historian of American foreign policy, doesn't say where. And it's I just want to get that on the record, and I just want to quick mention his tenets, which is democracy and accountability, anti-militarism, threat deflation, internationalism. It does say at the end here, by the way, University of Washington. I think internationalism explains itself, and I think we...
That's supporting the United Nations as it needs to be supported to carry out its functions.
International criminal courts, things like that. Anti-militarism, I think... I think that's been a progressive thing long before, you know.
It's been a constant theme of this show.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's the thing. That actually, to be honest, though, that might be the hardest sell to, like, the American people, sadly.
I don't understand, because it's a domestic and a foreign policy. Like, yeah. Hey, let's not starve ourselves to near death and fry the planet to a cinder because of our fear.
I just feel like really, like, reptile brain American politics, that's tough sell. But I agree with it. We agree with it. Okay. Democracy, I mean, that's obvious. I mean, it's been used as an excuse for a bunch of bullshit for
decades. I don't think America's ever actually supported a democracy, though. I mean, maybe Europe, arguably, but it's also one of the most clearly self-interested relationships we have.
Have we ever supported democracy? I think... Are you saying, have we ever started a war or gotten involved into a deadly military conflict in the name?
The democratic peace thing is, of course, mostly intact. Like, democracy is a notion they don't go to war with other democracies, but America, historically, is not necessarily supportive of democracies. I can name you at least a dozen countries off the top of my head where we, like, took out a democratically elected leader in favor of someone else.
Yeah. No, that's... I guess I'm just having trouble with the word support. Because, yeah, there's, like, tons of instances like that, like Indonesia, Iran,
Burkina Faso, yeah, Congo.
So many. But there's no instances where they supported a democratically elected person and, like, it was just sort of a boring story after that, you know? Like, it didn't lead to, like, rebellions and coups and... You know what I mean? Like we... And maybe I'm just being semantical, but we... I don't know. Pick a... Don't we support every democracy in the world? Like, almost?
Well, rhetorically. But practically? Not as strongly as we've supported people who didn't necessarily deserve it. Like, and that's probably his accountability point.
That's where I'm ultimately going. So, yeah, I guess let's don't get bogged down here. The accountability thing is like, man, when I saw that, that's when I knew the article was like speaking to me. And that, I think that's a really important addition. Because the rest seems very intuitive to me. The accountability thing is something that it's like, it makes the whole process work and function.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how he phrased it, but it would be like holding other foreign governments accountable, either in their international dealings with us and other people, but also in their dealings with their own people. For instance, one of the reasons that the TPP, that I was really, really against it, was it didn't necessarily address the palm plantations and the slavery that goes on in like Malaysia, who is going to be a signatory to the agreement. Mm-hmm. And those kind of labor practices need to have more of an effect in terms of our international institutions.
Mm-hmm. So I don't think that is not a part of what he's saying, but he's talking about the American foreign policy establishment having being held accountable.
What, Mike Pompeo? I mean, he hasn't necessarily fucked up anything yet.
Oh, no. I mean, I think he's going beyond that. I think he's... Okay, so, I mean, let me read. Quote, right. The American foreign policy establishment is notoriously forgiving of itself. Rarely are policymakers held to account when they offer bad advice, such as supporting...
Excuse me.
such as supporting a disastrous war in Iraq, or helping organize torture or assassinations. This amnesia has plagued Democrats and Republicans alike. This unaccountability cannot continue. A system that does not punish poor foreign policymaking is a system doomed to repeat its mistakes. And it goes on a little bit more.
Oh my God, that guy's talking about... actually holding people accountable for, like, criminals.
Yeah, that's in the third paragraph. Yep. Yeah. So, anyway.
With that, again, is that a domestic policy or a foreign policy? Because that's kind of some rule of law issues that he's going towards. Wait, okay, does he mention the International Criminal Court? I have to admit.
Not by name. So he says, okay, but professional accountability is not enough. The left should demand that those who violated domestic or international law see justice, even if that means prosecuting them. So he doesn't get into specifics of the International Criminal Court or anything like that. But he says this is a way that the American the left can demonstrate to the American people and the rest of the world that it is, quote, serious about the rule of law. I mean,
let's hold people to account. Honestly, we should send some people to Iraq.
I mean, this goes back to, I mean, you and I have been
talking about this since, like, the early 2000s.
2004. I mean, three, you know?
Yeah.
It didn't take long for the shit in Iraq for it to realize that it was a fraud. It was a
Even before then, I knew it was, like, the bullshit was already, the fix was in when W got elected. Because the operations tempo of at least my military unit completely changed. And we were like, well, we're going to do something big and overseas. It's like, okay.
Isn't that so weird because they were supposedly not world building?
But Bush, like, signaled so many times during that campaign that he was absolutely going to attack Iraq.
No, I know. He brought up Iraq and, yeah. Yeah.
And, yeah, the rest of the time before 9/11 was spent in command exercises to make sure all the commanders were going to be on the same page and that the ones that needed to be removed were removed before the invasion.
Yeah, it's interesting that they, how these politicians kind of, like, tiptoe around unpopular things, but they say them? Like, wouldn't you just not say anything if you knew it was something that was you had to tiptoe around? But they still make sure to signal someone, think tanks,
the people who were in favor of that. I mean,
yeah,
Bush. Like, there was not a small crowd of people that were cheering Bush's fucking attack of Iraq. We could bring up some footage here.
Yeah. But I am skeptical that he had votes in 2000.
He wouldn't have had it. They needed something. I mean, 9/11 probably wasn't an inside job.
I get that. I get that he couldn't start it right away. But what I'm saying is, you know how he didn't get the popular vote, but he would have lost the popular vote even more. Or I'm saying, I am skeptical that it made a difference. His signaling about Iraq to, like, voters, like, in the presidential election.
It was like him hedging his bets, saying, we're not for nation building, but we're going to rebuild the biggest country in the Middle East.
yeah, maybe it's kind of like, hey, you remember that guy Saddam, who we all told you was, you know, like, the devil, the Antichrist? It's like, I hate him, we're going to get him.
Yeah.
All right, so let's get to a couple specifics. Let's world hop a little bit.
Yeah.
Venezuela. Let's start close to home and go farther away.
The Lima Group, a diplomatic initiative started in Lima, Peru, last year to help, shall we say, mitigate the concerns of regional players about the ongoing crisis in Venezuela. Like, what, 14? Let me double check the numbers. Yeah, 14 of the 17 members, or 11 members, said that they were not in favor of any military action. So,
what does that mean?
I mean, we can't not expect the American president in his stable genius way to attack Venezuela unilaterally. But the regional players are not necessarily in favor of it, and this group also included Canada, so whatever that's worth. So most of Central and South America and Canada are not in favor of any military intervention. They'd like to see the situation get resolved with, like, diplomacy and other humanitarian initiatives.
Okay, can you tell me in a couple minutes why military intervention there, what that would look like?
Well, we would have to embargo all of their ports. Venezuela is a mountainous and covered in rainforests. Like, a lot of those dramatic waterfalls that you see are pictures from Venezuela, that, to give you an idea that we would need massive airlift capacity. Venezuela is, you know, Hugo Chavez embraced militarism, so they, like, down to, like, the street-level militias, they would be prepared for, shall we say, an act of resistance.
Yeah. It sounds like it's, like, Afghanistan mixed with Vietnam.
Yeah, in a lot of ways. But at least it's closer, so...
Yeah. Oh, great. Yeah, no, it's a huge country.
It's like, a huge...
There's a lot of people there, and it's big.
Millions.
I don't know if it's bigger than Iraq, but there's more people there than Afghanistan, but there's more people there than Afghanistan.
Yeah, but thousands, if not like whole percentage points of the country's population are leaving the country to the surrounding area, which is creating huge problems, as the Syrian crisis created for Turkey and Europe.
But what do they do? So what gets done?
So far, nothing. They didn't really agree to do anything.
But, I mean, like, if
so what?
Because, like, yeah. If their government isn't going to engage with other countries, then what do other countries do?
Well, they just cope with the problem as best they can. Brazil is doing some resettlement efforts to, like, you know, more broadly incorporate the refugees into their own society, so it's not left on to certain border states to shoulder the entire burden, because a lot of those places aren't exactly the richest in Brazil.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's basically country by country. And there have been agreements like, hey, we should put more resources. The country's bearing the brunt of the efforts, but among the Central and South American countries, they probably couldn't necessarily fill the donation hat for as much as is needed.
I will add here that in this article from the BBC that you linked to, it says, while many countries use the 1951 Refugee Convention to define a refugee, most of the region uses a broader definition shaped from the Cartagena Declaration on Refugees in 1984. It defines refugees as including people who have fled the country because of generalized violence and massive violation of human rights that have disturbed public order. So most Venezuelans would be classified as refugees.
That seems even a kind of a strict, but well, stricter than I understood of the 1951 definition.
Maybe it's that it specifically mentions these things so as to, like, leave no doubt that it... I don't know. That's just a guess, though.
It is absolutely applicable to these...
Yeah.
...or these people. But with Russia and China having control of the United Nations Security Council in favor of Maduro and the Venezuelan government, don't expect anything to happen at that level. Unfortunately.
All right, where to next?
Should we do Syria?
Right on.
So, Idlib, in the northwestern part of the country, has been the subject of negotiations in Sochi, Russia, over the last, they agreed to it on Monday, so it was Erdogan, Iran, Russia, and the rebels, I guess. I think the Turkish government was negotiating on behalf of the various rebel organizations.
Okay.
So, there are currently 12 Turkish military observation points around Idlib, like, basically at the borders, and maybe about 7 or 8 Russian observation posts and a handful of Iranian posts that are surrounding this area. And the agreement that they signed said that they would push... They would pull the rebels would pull their heavy weapons back, 10, 12 kilometers away from the demarcation line or the border. But there, I haven't seen anything about any necessitated Syrian response or, you know, compromise efforts. So that's, they're just asking the rebels to disarm their heavy weapons. Like, the rebel groups, notionally, like the approved ones, will be allowed their light weapons and, I guess, their lives, but the terrorist-aligned groups will be not given that kind of safe harbor. And it's the problem with this agreement going forward is that that is really, really not explained or defined at all.
Yeah, I was going to say, so who determines who's a terrorist?
Yeah, in the Turkish foreign minister, well, I'm not going to pronounce this badly, but Mevlüt Cavusoglu said the moderate opposition would keep its weapons and, quote, the region would be cleared of radicals and Turkey would make, quote, additional troop deployments. So they're guaranteeing this, and I guess it's going to be up to Erdogan's government to figure out who is a terrorist there. The Syrian government, of course, just wants the rest of their territory back. The rebels think that they won something out of this, and that the Turkish presence is going to keep this Syrian government out, but that seems like the hope of a desperate man.
Yeah.
Like, this situation could go very badly very quickly, and if the government's demand is pull your heavy weapons back, they're not exactly aiming to de-escalate this fight. They're just trying to get you to... or trying to make you an easier target.
Yeah. I mean, like, this Reuters report says, quote, Damascus also welcomed the agreement, but vowed to continue its efforts to recover every inch of Syria. So, it's like you have a couple weeks, it sounds like to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it says the terrorists are supposed to be evacuated somewhere, but there's nowhere left in Syria to go, so that, again, is a very, very dangerous gray area that it's not... There are no good decisions coming out of that kind of that line of thought from any of these parties involved.
It, you know, this thing strikes me as very interesting, though, is in that how often has there been... In your knowledge of history, a conflict, and one side isn't represented in the... I mean, I hesitate to call this a peace talk, but on some level it's ceasefire-type talk. Stand down.
Yeah, I can't think of any of them.
It's like...
The Basque had their representatives in negotiations, Yeah, I'm trying to think of, like, domestic insurgencies, because it's...
Because what part of this agreement...
is in favor of the... gives any kind of, favor for the rebels. I mean, notionally, it'll open up humanitarian avenues, and so maybe the area won't be as strongly besieged, but... they're depending on the people who sign this to... Yeah, I don't know. This isn't going to be enforced. Well,
and not even, like, a benefit to them, but, like, where's their responsibility? Like, where's their guarantee for their responsibility?
Hmm.
Like, they're... Okay, so, like, part of this is that... so this says, quote, Erdogan will create a demilitarized zone from which radical rebels must withdraw by the middle of next month. So... But... if they're not signing and privy to these discussions, why would they do that? Beyond the reason that existed before the talk, which is they're about to get bombed to hell. But, like, they already knew that.
Yeah.
I don't understand how the talks change anything for them.
Yeah, it doesn't really change anything, any of the facts on the ground. It just kind of puts a little bit of responsibility on Turkey and Syria, I guess. Gives them a couple of weeks of warning. They'll probably regroup and add reinforcements for their final assault.
Yeah, it's sort of almost like Turkey was like representing the rebels, but they don't have any sort of like ties to the rebels, really.
Yeah, they have. There's the what did they call themselves? They're not part of the FSA anymore. The part that the Turkish government peeled off into their own faction. Maybe their name isn't mentioned here, but. Yeah, they're sponsoring that group, but
okay. but not the whole.
Not the whole FSA.
This isn't like some big Turkish-sponsored rebellion.
Yeah. I mean, the Free Syrian Army is still there, and you got Tahrir al-Sham, the Army of God that was formerly the Al-Qaeda-aligned Nusra Front, mm-hmm. is still there in Idlib. There aren't reported any remnants of ISIS, but they just kind of faded in the background, so they might still be in the woodwork.
So we talked about Idlib. Oh, go ahead.
It's complicated, and mm-hmm. unfortunately it's complicated further because, I don't know if you heard this, but some Israeli F-16s did a standoff strike from Lebanese airspace, probably from somewhere over the eastern Mediterranean into western Syria, and the Syrian S-200 air defense system, in its response, shot down a Russian signals intelligence plane.
Sorry. Wait, so how does that specifically complicate it? Because that seems
it sort of complicates the Syrian-Russian relationship.
Yeah, okay, yeah. It sort of seems like a cartoonish way of complicating things, though.
Yeah, it's like some Keystone Cops or Three Stooges action where they're poking each other in the eye.
But why wouldn't... this is where I don't quite get, like... I'm sure I've said it before on the show, like international high-level diplomacy. Why wouldn't someone at Russia be like, okay, you guys are morons, but we don't think you're attacking us?
They blamed Israel.
Oh, they did? Oh, okay.
Yeah, but now
Russia's trying to do shit with Netanyahu. Okay, I see how this is, like, complicated. Yep, okay.
Yeah, and it gets complicated because Netanyahu apparently called Putin over the weekend to... probably whisper sweet nothings in his ear or something.
They already had that planned.
Yeah, but apparently Israeli F-35s have used American transponders and are known to use, like, fictitious call, some basic information warfare stuff to get their planes into dangerous areas. No, so shit. the theory that Russia's proposing is that they were shadowing the much larger signals intelligence plane because that's what the radar would pick up. When it was fired at them in the initial or the inevitable response, all they had to do is just fly low underneath that plane, and the S-200 radar system would pick out that plane, and the Israelis would get home.
So the two fighter jets would
probably four F-15s
would alert the people at the ground who are doing all the shit. But then once they decided to fire, the actual radar of the weapon would pick up the bigger plane.
No. Like, the S-200 is an integrated system where its radars and missiles are kind of like separate things. So the radar would pick up on the bigger Russian plane and send the missiles after that instead of the F-16s, or F-15s, which have a lower radar profile and were closer or lower to the ground, probably.
Well, that's what I'm saying, but why did they...
Why did they fire?
Well, yeah, like, if they picked up, then they're like, hey, look at that.
Well, it could have been for training, I would bet.
Oh, okay.
It's like, hey, we've got a contact, fire the missile! We've just got the order from above to fire the missile, because this was in Latakia province, like the heartland of, Assad's people, so... I'm sure they were panicking.
Jeez. Alright, and then...
And as if that cut wasn't complicated enough...
There's more? Oh my gosh.
No, I mean, that's about as complicated as I can make it for this episode, but... we'll leave it there.
Did you have any last... I mean, we talked kind of about Idlib and American responses and all that last week or a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, we'll see Mattis said nothing positive about it, so I wouldn't expect the Americans to do anything except stand by and watch and control their little bit of territory, which, again, the Syrians are going to try to take it, so that's a fight for another day, I guess.
All right, so then we are off to Myanmar.
Right, the fact-finding mission finally presented its 400-page report about the Rohingya genocide to the UN Human Rights Council on Tuesday, and said the Tatmadaw, Myanmar's military, had committed, quote, the gravest crimes under international law, unquote. Or, I'm sorry, 440-page report.
Yep.
Which describes, like, I've studied a lot of this stuff before, and I've read a lot about the terrible things that humans do to other humans, and this is a lot of that. I don't think I need to necessarily get into the details for our listeners, but...
I'm reading some of it now. Yikes.
Yeah, I wouldn't read this right before I go to bed.
I'm not reading the report, this Guardian.
The Guardian article alludes to, like, some of the worst parts.
Yeah. Pretty much what we've known in terms of, like...
This stuff is known. They presented their summary findings in August, and this is just, like, all of the data and evidence, like, finally compiled into a particular list, with their list of recommendations, of course, which includes justice, if not, like, prosecution for the Burmese senior military leaders, like the Commander-in-Chief, Min Aung Hlaing, and for genocide and crimes against humanity and other war crimes. And it said, quote, any engagement in any form with the Tatmadaw, its current leadership, and its businesses, which is a key point, is indefensible. The Tatmadaw is, well, Myanmar's just kind of getting out of being a military dictatorship, and so the military controls a lot of the businesses, especially the ones that have profitable foreign entanglements.
It also specifically mentioned Facebook as well.
Yeah, and of course, because Mark Zuckerberg can't keep his hands out of fire, but I guess we'll have all of a thought about him in the closing thoughts. Facebook is a way that a lot of the genocidaires propagated their message. Like, the radical Buddhist monks would call people together and assemble their militias to help the army wipe out whole villages, which were subsequently bulldozed. I think it was, 40 villages that the report documents that were just... Oh, 400. I'm sorry, I missed a zero. 400 whole villages were literally wiped off the map, according to satellite imagery.
The plan is to move them to a remote island that emerged from the sea in 2006?
Yeah, that's Bangladesh's way of alleviating the problem in Cox's Bazar with the overpopulated refugee camps, because there's currently no way that repatriation is feasible, practical, legal.
Explain that, because that might not be intuitive.
The UN that 1951 Convention on Refugees gives refugees some pretty strong protections in the event of, continued unrest. Like, they don't have to go back. Like, you can't force them to be repatriated to a place that's still unsafe. Which is why those credible fear tests and American asylum interviews are so key.
Yep. All right. Well, as we have once or twice before on the show,
there's no good answer.
Segment on a down note, specifically.
But this is actually kind of a positive note, because this is going to be the basis of the ICC's prosecutors, like, investigating and ultimately prosecuting crimes committed in the course of this. Because now they have, legal. Well, not exactly a legal document, but a body of evidence from an international body that they can use as a basis for, again, their prosecution and their indictments of figures.
Interesting.
So, yeah, somebody did them the favor and did the legwork.
I'll say this. We first talked about this, a year ago on the show? And it had been going on, I think, last summer. If I recall,
it's been going on for 30 years, but yeah, it got bad last
summer. But that really, like, big huge uptick where, it was something where it was like, it felt like elements of the world weren't acknowledging it, or like even almost like not believing it, but like that's not the case now. Like this,
no.
This for sure.
It is known.
Yeah. Puts to rest it being a ignored thing.
Right. 440 pages of evidence, it's tough to argue against.
All right.
I mean, it could have been made up, but man, writing fiction that long is very difficult.
Yeah, especially of that level of darkness. All right. Well, we will be back with some closing thoughts. And that was a little hop around the globe. And we're back with closing thoughts. CNBC is reporting that Mark Zuckerberg is selling up to $13 billion of Facebook stock to fund an ambitious project to end disease.
What? Yeah, I saw this just before we started recording, and it's been rolling in the back of my head the whole time we've been talking.
This is actually, reported over the weekend. What disease? So, what?
All disease? Yeah, it's managing all diseases, quote, in our children's lifetime, unquote. Like, Chen and Zuckerberg, or Priscilla Chen, his wife, and Mark Zuckerberg are trying to create a disease-free future for their children and spending up to $13 billion in the process. So if you're not already, I don't have any shares in Facebook. I don't think Pete does, but we have no interest in stock, but I'm going to tell you it's not a good stock to invest in the long term.
Facebook in general?
Yeah. I mean, I've been bearish on Facebook since it got started at $38 a share.
Well, what's it at now, though? I have a feeling. I have a feeling you've been wrong up till now. I think point taken. 10-year, 25-year, forecasts and all that.
I mean, over the past year, it's actually down slightly over the course of a year. It had a spike up to $220 a couple months ago, but since then it's settled back down.
Okay, but so if someone bought it at $38 when it first...
And now it's worth $160 now, but if you're a recent investor, I'm telling you, that's not where to put your money.
Hold on.
Admittedly, yes, if somebody had started out when they first started and bought their shares at $38 a share, they would have made a giant pile of money now. And that's the reason Zuckerberg is rich and able to sell $13 billion of it to fund an effort to vaguely end a human condition. But I'm bearish, especially on Facebook now, because between Cambridge Analytica and, shall we say, the ethical lapses revealed by Myanmar and other instances in Sri Lanka and other instances of the platform's failures in real human ways, it's not a pretty picture. I don't foresee them gaining any. Like, they already have the entire audience, so there's no growth prospects. And Ken Zuckerberg, does he have the strength of will and personality and the staff around him to maintain a monopoly? I would not necessarily bet on that.
Yeah, I mean, like, their whole thing is that they have to, like, yeah, you're right, growth potential is nil. And so it's like you have to, I mean, how much more time can they get out of their users, too?
Right, because the age demographic has got to be getting old, right? Now the kids are all going to Snapchat, well, Instagram.
But it's like unless Facebook is just your browser for doing the internet, which they're not that
for a certain group of people.
I know he's sort of that ambitious, but they aren't actually doing practical changes to Facebook that make you want to, beyond clicking on some GIFs and news stories, to actually use that to look through to the rest of the internet.
Yeah, it's not even AOL in its heyday.
Yeah. Yahoo or something. Yeah.
Right, and you can see on Facebook.
Like, why aren't they doing fantasy football? Like, why doesn't Facebook have a fantasy football program in Facebook that you could do with your friends?
Oh my god, that'd be awesome.
Right? It's like, it's easy fucking money. Why don't they do that? Like, things like that.
Yeah, because they're too worried about ethical and moral lapses right now.
And yet they support genocide. I mean, it's like, you guys aren't doing this right. Sorry, Facebook. Mm-hmm. Facebook rage.
genocide book.
It's like you got it. Like, they're so concerned about, like, they're somewhere between making money and that's all they care about, or they don't care about money and they're trying to, like, create, like, the human consciousness singularity. It's like they just need a more practical middle ground here.
Right, and they abandoned Zuckerberg's pie-in-the-sky idea before about putting up, like, what, drones as a stopgap internet?
I remember that.
Over developing areas like in India and Africa and South America, that idea got fucking vetoed. So what are they going to do? They keep buying Snapchat and Instagram and all these smaller competitors, but at a certain point, that's got to break because, come on, man, antitrust is a thing. The laws are on the book.
I agree. Because because that's the only thing that's really keeping them. Because like you sort of said, like, well, kids do Snapchat, but, you know, if they're owning all of these different companies, then they still reap the benefits. But yeah, at what point
does that start hurting their core business, like, brand, Facebook itself, that nobody really supports it or likes it?
Well, at what point does the government?
By the way, like and comment on our Facebook group. Tell me what to think.
Dude, so how long do you think until there is a major case involving breaking up one of the tech companies? Like, wasn't there almost one against Google a few years ago, but then they dodged out of it?
Yeah, the European Union is still on their cases, okay. Like the huge group companies. Like, they keep handing fines to Google, and I'm sure they've got to be mad at Zuckerberg for, like, not even showing up to their hearings.
Not surprised. All right, so let's head back home to Wisconsin. So,
hey, look at the Schimmel ad you posted.
Okay, so Schimmel. Brad Schimmel is the current Attorney General of Wisconsin. The Attorney General of a state is, I think, it's one of those things that gets the same kind of, like, I bet it's not that many more people can name, like, their state attorney general then can name, like, one person on their school board or something.
Oh, man, don't put me in that spot.
I can't either, don't worry about it. it's incredibly important. Just like your district attorney, you know, they are making so many decisions. And so many decisions on behalf. It's not just like, okay, the state is state's Department of Justice is, like, you know, bringing criminal charges against someone, or even doing, well, like, go ahead.
I was going to say, the thing about that is that it's usually left up to the AG, at least it has been in the, like, last few years, that whenever there's an officer-related shooting, the prosecution of it immediately goes up to his office.
That just happened in Manitowoc, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. That is correct.
And, you know, the 1,001 fucking lawsuits that he's bringing against every fucking federal organization that he can put in his crosshairs.
Well, that's what I was going to say. So, like, on the one hand, Schimmel is one of many AGs who, you know, hey, even idiots stumble into good ideas every now and then, who, like, is suing opioid companies for all of those problems, right?
Late to the game.
But he also is, you know, regularly, like, commonly treating our State Department of Justice in these lawsuits against federal agencies and federal laws that are, I mean, on one hand, I want to say they're all frivolous. Maybe they're not even all frivolous, but, like, I don't think he's accurately representing us. Like, when he's grouping us in with, like, Alabama and Texas on these suits, like, I feel as if he's, like Wisconsin's a purple state, and he's, you know, happens to be a Republican. But, like, we aren't those states, and we shouldn't be represented like we are. But I don't know, that's a kind of a broader problem, I guess, that we're dealing with.
Yeah, but he doesn't need to, yeah, keep dragging our name through the mud by associating us with terrible ideas and, well, not vexatious lawsuits, but problematic lawsuits?
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're like the ones that, like, sue goddamn Obamacare and sue
It just maybe scores up things
like gay marriage or whatever it is.
Yeah, it's a political point. So he's using the state funds for his own political benefit, and you know, it makes for a good campaign ad.
Yeah, but instead, he's actually doing a campaign ad featuring. So he's claiming that you know, all of the sheriffs like him better than his opponent, and who is Josh Call, actually the son of a former state attorney general, the drunk driving one. and so he made an ad that features a. It's like really kind of convoluted, so I'm not going to try and get into every detail. But there is a county sheriff in Wisconsin who had a deputy who tried to give cold cases to a television program called Cold Justice without permission, which is wrong. And the sheriff directed one of their IT people to hack into that sergeant's Dropbox account. I think that sums it up.
Yeah, wow. That's like some interesting federal, potentially, things. But...
Well, apparently he's not getting prosecuted by anyone at all.
He certainly isn't. He under investigation? Please.
I think he was. Is he currently, though? I thought he was, and they cleared him, but I could be wrong. But anyways, he's in the ad. I thought the other bullshit thing about the ad, though, was that it was like, even Democrat sheriffs support Brad Schimmel. And I think my comment on Twitter was, you know, the famous conservative whack job Sheriff David Clark from Milwaukee was, like, Democrat, technically.
Yeah, right? The Wisconsin Department of Justice definitely should have prosecuted him for the death in his jail. For instance,
David Clark, for sure. Well, and just, well, not they should get prosecuted for this, that would be wrong, but also he's just like an outspoken showman of a conservative. I think it's actually really common for there to be, quote, Democrat sheriffs that, are as right-wing as anyone else.
They're in the law and order business. In that career, there's only like one opinion, right?
No.
Well, I'm.
Yeah. No, I know what you mean.
Typically, they're all law and order, and at best, they're like trying to put a humanitarian face on the adjudication of justice, and at worst, they're on the other end of the spectrum, which...
Yeah. Well, you know, it's like when law and order is code for racism... I think some people, like, are just, like, legit Law and Order people, and then they just get, like, sucked into being racists.
Hmm.
That's a very too kind interpretation of things.
Yeah.
but anyway, no, I think there's a lot that are... Because, like, I think David Clark's situation was not terribly unique across the country, where it's, like, those conservative types... are drawn to that job, specifically that job in law enforcement, but obviously law enforcement in general. And certain cities, like how many people in Madison, Wisconsin, are going to vote for the Democrat sheriff because...
His name's on the ballot.
They're just voting straight party, right?
Right.
In Milwaukee, I think that's why David Clark did it. I do think, on the other hand, too, though, there's, like, Republicans who win even in areas that are Democrat-leaning.
Mm-hmm.
Like, maybe not single-party states like Madison, frankly, is.
Yeah, like Rock County.
Yeah. I think Racine, which, you know, before the kind of recent stretch of being totally Republican, it used to vary back and forth and... I think they almost always had a Republican sheriff. It's just people go there and they're like, you know, people who were like, you know, back in the days when they were like a little bit more in the way of centrists and all that.
I know my mom used to vote for a Republican sheriff, and before I was old enough to vote, I was in the booth with her.
But she would vote for Democrats for some other offices, though.
Yeah, straight yeah. Democrat ticket, except for sheriff.
Interesting. Yeah, there you go. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that's that unique. I think a lot of people do that.
Yeah.
Anyway, so this guy is putting out some doofy ads, and he apparently, we will get to in a second, is leading in the polls, which is really disappointing. Because, honestly, I think I could almost take 4 more years of Scott Walker if Schimmel was voted out. And I know that's blasphemous to say. But I really, really dislike a prosecutor.
All right, let's get a paper bag.
Me.
And just stuff it with dollar bills amounting to about half the money that Schimmel has wasted on vexus litigation. And then run that against Schimmel, and I bet the paper bag would win.
I think that's a good point. Well, wait, can you spend the money from the paper bag?
Yeah, it just goes into state coffers.
Oh, I thought it was just, like, that was the guy you put on stage in the debate, was just a paper bag full of money.
And, yeah, and, you know, because it's like, it's such a visual, yeah.
But can the paper bag with money run ads, is what I'm saying.
I mean, I assume they'd have to take some of the money out of the bag.
Okay. Then, yes, I agree. I think that would go, would do well. And by the way, I don't want to I don't take this as making fun of Josh Call. The little bit I know about Josh Call, who I remember when he actually announced he was running, I looked into some of his policies and what he was saying. He actually has a good stance on criminal justice reform and issues of race and discrepancies in incarceration. Which is kind of like my number one issue for the Attorney General.
Right.
So, anyway, to these polls. Marquette poll was released. As far as I know, Marquette polls are considered fairly reliable.
Isn't it Charles Franklin?
I believe.
Yeah, Charles Franklin's poll, of course.
I believe he runs it. Yeah. Marquette University Law School Survey. It shows Tony Evers, the current state school superintendent, with 49%. Governor Walker at 44%.
Woo!
6% for Libertarian Phil Anderson. Which, I don't know how I feel about that. I think, though, Libertarians are always going to get 5% in Wisconsin.
I don't see any Tony Evers sign, but there's a yard here in Beloit that has like 6 of the signs for that guy.
I didn't even hear about him until just now. Wow. Okay.
How many Evers signs have you seen? I've seen a couple of Mandela Barnes here because he's popular, but no Tony Evers.
I don't see that many signs. There's like one house that's on my drive that I go to the grocery store and to school, and I spend most of my time on the Beltline. There's no yards.
Mm. Like not even billboards?
There's no billboards. Yeah, why aren't there billboards? Mm. Why would they not pay for billboards? Aren't even that expensive.
Yeah, right? Anyways.
They have to be, whatever.
Whatever.
Especially like for a stretch of road that is prone to traffic jams. You might as well throw a billboard up. And so, also, Tammy Baldwin is extended her lead over Leah Volkmir.
Volkmir?
Is it Volkmir?
I assume it's pronounced like it's like she's Darth Volkmir.
Unfortunately.
It sounds like a Sith, the name of a Sith Lord to me, but...
The Marquette poll article I brought up does not have it does not have
senatorial race.
I know it was a previous article. Okay, she is up by 11 points now, according to Marquette. But Schimmel.
Wait, is Cleefish's race in there? Barnes Cleefish.
Don't you or vote
just
for
5 points? Is it the same? I guess it is.
Yeah, I think, like, they run their... So the way they do it in Wisconsin, I don't know if other states are the same, is that the lieutenant governors and governors run separately in their primaries, and I suppose they are technically... I th-
they might technically be different spots on the ballot. I'm trying to think back for the general election, but like there is pretty much no difference.
Like, yeah, they share resources.
Yeah, like they campaign together, and I think at this point they pretty much coordinate in the run up to the general. Mm-hmm. This is interesting. Vukmir was supported by 86% of Republicans, which is a big number.
Mm-hmm.
Baldwin was backed by 97% of Democrats.
All right, who are you 3% of fucks that don't support Tammy Baldwin?
Yeah, that is crazy. That's just standard. I mean, that's just the
margin of error.
Yeah, margin of error. I would assume. Yeah, among independents, Baldwin led 54-38. The poll found Baldwin trouncing Vukmir among white female college graduates 64-30.
Oh man.
She is crushing her in women.
Yeah, Vukmir has no chance.
Here we go, though. Here's our people, Charles. Oh, actually, first of all, the first stat is not our people. Vukmir had an advantage with non-college white males, 54-41. Oh, here we go, Charles. White college males, evenly divided.
God damn it.
We're coming back, though. Dude, we lost that in 2016.
Yeah, we were pretty... The white men in general kind of embarrassed us in 2016.
I mean, they were like... Granted, it was more so the non-college, but in general, white college, or white males, went hard for the Republicans that year. All right, so that goes over the polls. Do you still stand by your, what did you say, 3-4% last week for Evers?
I mean, that's within the margin of error for this poll, so I feel vindicated.
Oh, for sure. Well, so I think he's up by 5 here, which is, I think, outside the margin of error.
I mean, Scott Walker just bought that huge media buy. And it's going to start taking effect in the next poll, so we'll see how well Tony Evers can, or how nimbly he can respond to that, but unfortunately I'm not optimistic.
But you still think Evers wins by 3-4%.
Yeah. Currently, that's my projection. Tony Evers still wins by at least 3-4%, but man, he really has to start hitting on at least one policy cylinder. Please, just give me a plank. It's something to chew on, like a beaver.
I don't feel any better, despite... Like, I don't feel more confident about him winning, even though a poll came out with him having a bigger lead than any poll before. I mean, by the way, a couple things about this poll. I believe this is the first time Walker has ever been down in a Marquette poll. At least in the governor poll.
I think Charles Franklin just changed the... sample for this poll.
Like,
I think I think it's some more cell phone users. I haven't seen.
Oh, it should be more representative.
Yeah, it's more representative of what a blue wave might. The people who would be coming to the polls to support a blue wave, if there is going to be one.
You have to be careful how you word that, though. So, is it more representative of the likely voter? Which more, in this case happens to include, quote, blue wave voters?
I think it in just generally, in general terms, it included more Democrats in the sample.
But is that more?
I mean, as you pointed out, we're a purple state, and Marquette at least leans conservative. I mean, admittedly, he hasn't been wrong, but.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, I see what you're saying. I would like to know how he, like, what the polls, how far they were off right before the last couple elections.
I mean, I guess we could go back and look.
Yeah.
But,
yeah. Maybe we should do that the week of the election. We should have an election extravaganza.
Yeah, let's go. The data extravaganza.
Yeah, there you go.
Extravagata?
Oh, let me give one more last thing about the poll, because I did like this. This is interesting to me. 45% of voters had a favorable opinion of Walker. 40% had a favorable view of Evers. No, it doesn't seem. Okay, yeah, and that's kind of speaking to what you've been talking about, actually. Because it's like, it seems like people want to like him, but they're like, I don't even know why. Why would I like
him? There's no likable there. It's, I mean, he's a skinny guy, but there's got to be something to him, right?
However, 52% had an unfavorable opinion of Walker. 29% only had an unfavorable view of Evers. That's your difference.
Yeah, that's the huge difference right there. Scott Walker has so much history, and I remember when he was like, no, I'm going to be governor, and I'm going to be dedicated to governor, and then he ran for president, and then he was the first one out and embarrassed the entire state, and cost the Republican establishment Rince Priebus in the process, or at least Rince Priebus' access to the federal level of power.
Okay, so let me tell you about this one, though. I swear the last one. It might not be the last one. He has actually a lot of cool poll stats here. But we're not talking all about that. But just because we did mention Call. So I said earlier before how Call is losing to Schimmel in the Attorney General's race. Mm-hmm. I'll give you the numbers. It's 48-41. Now here is what is... I don't know what this means. 87% didn't know enough about Call to have an opinion of him.
I'm looking at his website, and I don't know enough about him to have an opinion.
For Schimmel, 24% had a favorable... This actually speaks to what I was saying about the school board. 24% had a favorable opinion, 20% had an unfavorable opinion, and 56% didn't know enough to have an opinion of the, what, two-term attorney general?
Yeah, right? This guy has not been shy about seeking our camera and attention.
I think this is seeking his third term. I could be wrong about that. But either way... he is the incumbent. That is wild to me. But here's the thing, though. Okay, so that's going to kind of, I think, make this poll less reliable. Because how many people are going to go to the polls and vote for Evers, vote for Tammy, and then say,
I mean, I guess I'm here.
I've heard of Schimmel before. Like, I don't know, some people?
I mean, he's kind of an asshole for various reasons, so...
It just doesn't seem like if there's already a couple elections drawing out blue voters, that wouldn't give a significant bump to a down-ballot race, which I guess the attorney general is a down-ballot race.
It's a statewide race, but it's down-ballot.
From Senate and governor, yeah. I don't know. It seems like he might not be in as bad a position as a 7-point deficit might seem. But man, he needs some funds. Just like throw out like an ad or two, just don't make them like shitty attack ads.
Yeah.
And speaking of shitty attack ads, as you referenced earlier, the Koch network pumps $1.3 million into Wisconsin to boost Walker, according to The Hill by Max Greenwood. So, is it Americans for Prosperity, which we'll be able to find out who's paying for them pretty soon, announced they are doing $1.3 million on digital and TV ads, hitting Democratic candidate Tony Evers.
Ugh.
I will say...
On what?
Well, it's isn't it just those... They've already been running ads for a couple weeks.
One teacher rape case?
Yeah, it's the teacher thing.
God damn it.
But I'll say this, though. I think the Franklin pointed out in the Marquette poll that Walker has gone down since... Now, this would be before the American for Prosperity money, but he's gone down since he started a big negative ad blitz on Evers. Maybe it's a turnoff. It's not unreasonable. I mean, it's hard to sit... Like, I watch Meet the Press, okay? And that's the only place I've seen these ads is on Meet the Press, or during Meet the Press.
I mean, that's the people that they're aiming for.
It is uncomfortable on Sunday morning to be sitting there, the sun shining in through your picture window, drinking your coffee, watching talking heads go at it, and it cuts to commercial, and they're talking about porn and rape.
Ugh.
Like, that doesn't... I mean, I'm not even like a classic Midwestern prude or anything. But I mean, like, and I didn't even have kids in the room or anything. It's just, but I'm like, this is distasteful. Like, I don't even like to, why do I have to watch this during Meet the Press on Sunday morning?
Right. To stand in as Walker's campaign manager here for a second, you know, you got a guy who spent at least a couple years and several more in Tony Evers' case in a policy level position. Attack him on the policies because there's probably whole fucking volumes of Oppo research you could put into that. But instead, he's attacking him on clickbaity fucking bullshit.
That's all he has. Like, and then going after... Okay, we're going to switch into this now. Going Cleefish going after Mandela? Did you see that?
Yeah, I've been following that. I retweeted some of that. Like, her coded racism. Did you see the Tweaky or the Tiki Torches comment?
No. What?
Mandela Barnes was like, oh, let me... It was really, really funny.
Oh, he made a comment. Okay, I thought
he made a comment about, you know, Tiki Torches, and she responded in... Hang on a second, I gotta pull this
up. Okay, no, yeah, because I love this idea of, like, so racists have coded racism. So, like, people who are anti-racists have, like, coded... Now have coded ways of calling out racism. It's great.
Yeah. Like the OK symbol, which they somehow stole when we weren't looking.
God, I almost wanted to make it the other day, and I was like,
I'm not a racist. God damn it. Well, you know, the Nazis took the Roman salute, which had been standard across Europe for hundreds, if not thousands of years. Really? So
I didn't even know that. Yeah. Because they don't have them do it in Roman movies probably enough.
Yeah, because it made them look like Nazis. So
God damn it. It's like, white supremacists have to ruin everything.
Everything. Okay, so the whole thing about Rebecca Cleefish and Mandela Barnes is that she on Twitter took to saying that people told her that they saw Mandela Barnes kneeling during the anthem at the opening of the state fair. She adds that she was looking at the flag and didn't see it because, you know, she has a one-track mind and her attention can only be dedicated to one thing at a time. Mandela Barnes responded... Her responded, I was around so many people, I was right next to the cameras, quote, this is too stupid to respond to, unquote.
Dude, I like Mandela. I like him a lot. Yeah,
me too. I wish he were the governor.
He spoke at the Bernie rally I went to, actually.
Nice.
Yeah, he was, I think, one of the first or second speakers.
I had Randy Bryce for the one in Janesville, which...
Well, it was a Randy Bryce.
Yeah. Rally. Well, it was
he spoke too.
I mean, I was there for Bernie, to be honest, and I didn't really necessarily want to put a dollar into that race.
I was there for Randy Bryce. I actually was interested in seeing him talk. But go on. Oh, yeah.
Anyways,
back to Mandela.
Rebecca Cleefish. Rebecca Barnes, oh my god, what's wrong with me? Rebecca Cleefish responded, as I always do, I was looking at the flag with my hand over my heart. She did not see Mandela Barnes. And then Mandela Barnes, of course, responded to, like, saying, quote, this is like me saying my neighbor saw her buying a tiki torch at Menards, unquote. And then she responded, I don't know if she has to know, right?
No, dude, have you seen anyway, her talk? She not have to know anything.
She tweeted... But here's the thing. The national anthem is not like tiki torches. It's a big deal that matters, in parentheses, just like abortions are not like tonsillectomies, end parentheses.
Dude, she doesn't know.
It's like a Zen koan, almost. This tweet has so many... like, it's the layers of a rotten onion that you just keep pulling apart because you just hate yourself.
Sorry, this is the funniest thing I've heard all day. She is completely oblivious to the Tiki Torches reference. That went, like, right
through. No, I took it like she knew. Like, she's saying that the national anthem is more important than, you know, any support or, I guess, opposition. But I'm probably sure... I probably think she would support the white supremacists.
Okay, so...
But I don't understand.
To me, what you just said reads as her not getting it. She thinks Mandela Barnes brought up a trivial factual error for his hypothetical. And she's like, but what would that matter? We're talking about the national anthem. And so I'm willing to give her the benefit of the doubt, which is bad, right? That's really bad.
That she is totally ignorant of
Charlottesville. Like, that's crazy that anyone who's a fucking public figure in politics doesn't know anything about that.
Part of the brand of tiki torches, unfortunately, as much as the company tries to distance themselves from it.
Or she's just like, okay. But then the other side, I mean, you're right. Maybe she did get it, and she's just, like, dismissive, which is gross.
not ignorant, but it's gross. It's ignorant in like that racism is ignorant kind of way.
Kind of way. But she is an incumbent lieutenant governor. But what about the abortions line? I don't...
Okay, so wait, read that back. She said, just like abortions are not like tonsillectomies?
Yeah. The national anthem is not like tiki torches, in that they're a big deal that matters, just like abortions are not like tonsillectomies, I guess, in the fact that they're a big deal that matters to her base. So I guess it's just a coded message in at least two ways.
I think...
Like, because her supporters have to know what tiki torches means, right?
Dude, I don't know, because, like, there's people who I think... I mean, to me, it's inexcusable that someone, like, how can you be that out of touch as lieutenant governor of a, like, politically, like, important state? Wisconsin, the nexus of all American politics. But, I mean, but, I don't know, there's probably people out there who don't watch national news, who don't really pay that much attention, who go to church, and who think abortions are the worst thing in the world. Period.
But at the same time, it is known that there are Atomwaffen Division members here in fucking Wisconsin. Like, the white supremacists are among us.
Well, now they know who to vote for.
Well, if they didn't, they were already going to.
Well, I don't know. That libertarian candidate was... No, I'm just kidding.
Let's split the white supremacist vote.
I'm sure Phil's a nice guy. That was his name, right, Phil?
He's probably a nice guy. Libertarians are mostly well-meaning.
Yeah. Here's the thing about libertarians. I don't think that, like, obviously, I don't think their ideas are all that great when you kind of take them as a whole.
Yeah,
but I mean, the difference between a libertarian and a Koch kind, like Koch brother type libertarian, who, right, the Koch brothers, who is it? I think it was Charles. Ran for libertarian as their VP. He was a big libertarian guy. He's like, okay, we're not getting anywhere. So he switches teams, throws billions into it, think tanks, universities, like charities, PACs, everything.
He creates a whole fucking industry around his thoughts about how, and invades the Republican Party.
Because he's ambitious with it.
Yeah, and that's why we have...
That's the difference.
That's why kind of like the Tea Party assholes are, even still kind of a thing, because they were flush with his money.
Oh, and he was laying the groundwork for literally Tea Party type things like that for like a decade or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's... Like, libertarians, hey, man, they're just like any other kind of like... I just view them like, they're just like a fringe political group. They're entitled to their thoughts. I don't have a big problem with them. I mean, it sucks if they, like, were to sway an election in some way that, that's against what I think. But that sucks for me,
Right. They have good ideas. I mean, as I said, I'm a socialist libertarian or lean socialist libertarian. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, people...
They have problems with externalities, which... really, really hamstrings their whole philosophy.
I mean, I don't like their views on business, the role of government in business. But, civil libertarians, it's a reason it has that name, right?
Yeah, right? I don't want the government looking into my email any more than anybody else, so...
and then I think... Did we get to all the little Scott Walker? Yeah.
Oh, he's having a new campaign. Campaign event up in Wausau today, funded by Foxconn. So that's a thing.
Okay, yep. So more campaigning with Foxconn, using events that are notionally about announcing how our government is wasting money on a big foreign-owned business, and he is using it to campaign for re-election.
Right. Well, I mean, he gave them billions of dollars. So this is probably the kickback.
Not part of it. His billions, though.
I mean, that's the best part of political corruption. It's never their billions.
All right, and let's end with... Did you see the story I put here? It's called Don't Vote for This Guy. It's from the Isthmus, which is a local weekly free periodical in Madison, Wisconsin. And the byline is Comedian Nick Hart's Semi-Serious Run for Mayor by Dylan Brogan. So, do you know Nick Hart?
I do not know Nick Hart.
So, Nick Hart has been a stand-up in Madison for as long as I have been going to stand-up shows, so, shit, 6-7 years, but I bet he's been doing it longer than that. He ran for mayor once before, it says here in the article. He placed a distant third in the 2011 mayoral primary against two heavyweights, then-Mayor Dave Shishlevich and current Mayor Paul Soglin. Hart says his last run, in which he received less than 2% of the vote, accomplished, quote, absolutely nothing. What's interesting about this, though, is because I didn't really know him. Like, I've talked with him before, hung out with him once or twice. I'm not claiming we're friends or anything. And I've seen his shows numbers of times, including he did an hour-long, almost more like a one-man show once, very autobiographical. And he also is, I think, the reigning Madison, the best comedian in Madison or whatever it's called. And he was on Conan O'Brien, actually, a few weeks ago.
Interesting.
And he is running, because Paul Soglin in Madison is not running for re-election. He's announced this. So there are 7 people who've announced they're running for mayor. Nick Hart is one of them. And what is interesting here is that when he first ran, I had heard about it, but I didn't know him or know. I didn't really read about his rationale. It's like there were a bunch of people.
Signatures. You should run.
I saw that. He's like, yeah, he had, quote, I don't understand why there aren't 50 candidates running. It's not hard. You only need 200 signatures to get on the ballot.
We definitely know 200 people.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. The idea of canvassing is, like, one of my great fears in life. I just, ugh. Knocking on a stranger's door, it's, like, really hard for me to, like, overcome that fear.
We'll have to go canvassing sometime.
Yeah, I guess I do. I keep, like, thinking, like, you know, I should just get out there and, like, try and, like, make the world a better place. And then I'm like, ooh, but strangers
Everybody who listens to this podcast should make some kind of effort to go out and be more politically active, like get like phone banking, canvassing, like just creating civil organizations, which are rapidly atrophying across America's culture. Does anybody know what Robert's Rules of Orders even are anymore? Come on, people.
Hey, man, I had to research that a lot from Model UN in high school. We tried to use the rules of order to as procedural leverage as often as we could. anyway, but what's really interesting is that he actually has like sort of a point to this. He's like, it's not a publicity stunt, and apparently he like did a comedy show the day that the article writer like that day, and you know Nick Hart didn't mention that he was running for mayor at all. He says it's a way to get people out. He's like, if I win the election, how does he put it? I want to get his exact quote here. Y'all are fucked.
And by that, by y'all, he means the status quo, and I'm all in favor of that.
Quote.
He seems to have a really iconoclastic view towards government.
Oh, yeah. Quote, I'm a teachable moment. You better get involved, or else you'll get somebody like me. And it's interesting because he's not going to like seek donations. I know him. He's not going to like. The point is that, and you know, and he's like, we call ourselves a progressive city. Why aren't there more people running? How come we only get
20% of the city that votes? Come on.
In local elections, yep, exactly. And as someone who's in that 20%, who once had a lived in a house with many other people and. Our alderman came and knocked on the door and knew my name because I was apparently the only voter from that house, regular voter. He's like,
I don't think I was registered when I lived
there. No. This was, I think, before you lived there. He's like, you're what we call a spring voter or something like that. He's like, I'm like, what the hell is that? He's like, you vote in every election. I'm like, yeah, I do. That's me.
I know when this was. Yeah, I registered from where I was around the corner from you.
So, anyway. It's
He's got some good issues, though, Josh Hart.
Nick Hart.
Nickhart, sorry.
That's okay. Josh Call, AG,
right.
Nickhart, long shot candidate for mayor.
Four-letter words.
But I like that. I don't know. I actually hadn't, I mean, as much as I've, like, heard his comedy before and knew that he ran for mayor once before, I didn't know his rationale behind it, and I find it really interesting. It's a civic engagement sort of stunt. It's not a publicity stunt, though.
Yeah.
That's interesting. All right. And on that note, this has been Tell Me What to Think. You can find us on Twitter at Bloated Nemesis. Charles is at @green_weird. Hashtag TMWTT. Email TMWTTPOD@gmail.com. Go to www.stoneduckmedia.com to see past episodes. Hit us up on the Facebook and the Google Play and the Apple Pod and the Stitcher. Anything else I'm forgetting?
Not that I can think of. Try to have a good week. Keep your heads up.
All right, later, everyone.
Today's sunny. Today's a race. Destroy the myth and we'll break our chains. Break your chains.